Good evening.
Welcome to the Salt Lake City Public Library's speaker series commemorating the 150th anniversary of the nation, and welcome to the Nancy Tessman Auditorium of the main library of the City Library. I'm John Spears, Salt Lake City Public Library Executive Director, and I want to thank all of you for attending tonight. I'd also like to welcome our audiences on SLC TV and KCPW Radio. Recordings will be available from both of those organizations after this event as well, online. I don't know how many of you can see this, but I'm wearing a button that says National Welcoming Week. And how many of you know what today is? It's Citizenship Day, and it's Constitution Day. 228 years ago on this date, the Constitution of the United States was signed. And as a part of that, we guarantee certain rights of citizenship, natural born, and a process whereby someone can become a citizen. Today at the Glendale Library, we had an event for Citizenship Day involving the Mayor McAdams, Mayor Becker, numerous state senators and state representatives, and several organizations dedicated to naturalizing immigrants to this country. And we also heard from many people who had come to this country and had recently become naturalized citizens, one yesterday and one today. What they shared were incredible stories about what it means to be an American and what it means to be a citizen of this country. And the one thing that everyone said was most important to them was the right to vote. It's something that many of us take for granted, something that many residents of this country don't even do, but it's something that all of us should do, and it's something that is incredibly important, and it's the topic of tonight's conversation. So the nation, in 2015, the nation is going to be celebrating, is celebrating its 150th anniversary, and the City Library's collection contains printed copies of the nation back to 1880. Since its founding in 1865, so if you do the math, we're only missing 15 years of 150 years, the nation has been a home for writers instigating, investigating, reporting on, and arguing about struggles for social and economic justice. We're going to be hosting 7 speakers and a film screening to note this milestone anniversary. Some of the past topics in this series have included the environment with Mark Hertzgard, 2016 presidential election with George Zornick, and reproductive rights with Katha Paulett. Upcoming topics include money and politics with John Nichols, privacy rights with Zoe Carpenter, and race and policing with Michael Denzel Smith. A full lineup of the events is available at the table outside the auditorium. I'd also encourage you to visit slcpl.org/thenation for more information about the series and to register for the series as well. Registration is not required. All events in the series are free and open to the public. But anyone who registers and attends will be entered into a drawing to win weekly events-related prizes. Normally, if you've been to these before, you know that I would do that now, but we're going to do it a little differently tonight, and we're going to wait until the end. But tonight's prizes, I can give you a teaser, are a copy of Ari's book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, a nation tote bag and a hat, and some limited edition honey from our own hives. And I would like to do a shameless plug for the City Library's honey. We are extremely proud to announce that we placed 3rd in the Utah State Fair. So a couple just logistical things really quick. To make sure that those on SLC TV and KCP Double Radio can hear your questions at the end of this, when we're going to be doing a Q&A, please wait for a City Library staff member to bring you a microphone. Also, following the event, we're going to have a reception downstairs in our lower urban room. And at that reception, the Friends of the City Library and the library store will be selling Ari's book and also subscriptions to the nation. The nation has also very generously agreed that half of the subscription price will be donated back to the Friends of the City Library. So at the conclusion of the Q&A, there's auditorium exits at the bottom of the stairs on each side of the room that will lead you to the reception area. But don't forget to wait to see if you won the prize first. And now I'd like to introduce Janetta Williams. Janetta Williams is president of the NAACP Salt Lake Branch and the NAACP Tri-State Conference of Idaho, Nevada, and Utah. She was elected to the NAACP National Board of Directors and served 6 years under the leadership of her friends and civil rights icons, Merle Evers Williams and Julian Bond. She's a member of numerous organizations and has served 20 years on the West Valley Police Citizens Professional Standards Review Board. She's been instrumental in the passage of numerous legislative bills in the state of Utah and initiated and led the successful effort to change Utah's Human Rights Day to to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the year 2000. She served as co-chair of the pre-adjudication committee of the Utah Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Legal System. She's responsible for the naming of Rosa Parks streets in Utah and a bench dedication. She's received NAACP national awards and recognitions, as well as many local awards. Please join me in giving a very enthusiastic welcome to an incredible woman, Ms. Janetta Williams.
Good evening, and thank you for that very kind introduction. A little bit about the NAACP and our history and our Voting Rights Act, as I also introduce our speaker this evening. Despite the fact that African Americans and other racial and ethnic minority Americans are guaranteed the right to vote by the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which was passed after the Civil War in 1870, states and local municipalities continue to use tactics such as poll taxes, literacy tests, and outright intimidation to stop people from casting free and unfiltered ballots. During the civil rights activism of the 1960s, just 5 days after Martin Luther King Jr. led the March on Selma, President Lyndon Johnson announced his intention to pass a federal Voting Rights Act to ensure that no federal, state, or local government may in any way impede people from registering to vote or voting because of their race or ethnicity. In 1965, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. There were three enforcement-related provisions of the Voting Rights Act that would have expired in August 2007 unless reauthorized. The first in Section 5, which requires certain jurisdictions to obtain approval or preclearance from the U.S. Department of Justice or the U.S. District Court in D.C. before they can make any changes to voting practices or procedures. The Supreme Court, in their ruling in June of 2013, struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 by a 5-4 vote. And I'm not going to say any more about any of that because I think our speaker may talk something or give you additional information. But I'd like to, and I'm very honored to introduce our speaker this evening, which is Ari Bergman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He has written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. His stories have also appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and The Guardian, and he is a frequent guest and political commentator on MSNBC, C-SPAN, and NPR. His first book, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, was published in October 2010. In August 2015, he released Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He graduated from Northwestern University with a degree in journalism and political science. Please welcome our speaker and our honored guest, Ari Bergman.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you to the Public Library for having me. It's a beautiful building. It's an honor to be here. Thank you, Ms. Williams, for your beautiful introduction. And thank you for The Nation, my employer, for doing this for 150 years. In this day and age, that's pretty impressive. And there's not that many places like The Nation. And that's one reason why it's so great to work there. And so I want to talk tonight, as John mentioned, about voting rights. And it's a very good time to talk about voting rights on Constitution Day, really the best time, because the vote is one of the most powerful parts of our Constitution and also one of the most debated parts of our Constitution. And my book, Give Us the Ballot, really tells the story of what's happened with the vote since the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the battles that have emerged in the decades since. So I want to go back to the founding of our republic and talk about kind of a fundamental contradiction of American democracy. The fact that we are a country that's known as the land of the free, the home of the brave, that we're famous for exporting democracy all across the world. I'm sure many of you watched the Republican debate last night at the Ronald Reagan Library, and Reagan famously called America the shining city on the hill that had been a beacon of light to so many others. Unfortunately, we're also a country that has limited the most fundamental rights from the founding of our republic. When the Constitution was ratified in 1787, only white male property owners could vote in the 11 states of the Union. At the end of the Civil War, a war that was fought for reasons of equality and justice, black men could only vote freely in 5 states. Women weren't given the right to vote till 1920, and it was only white women, because in so many states, black women couldn't vote. And even when we had passed protections for voting rights, and as Janetta mentioned, we passed a 15th Amendment in 1870 that said very clearly, the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And those words meant something for a brief period. During Reconstruction, after the Civil War, federal troops were sent to the South. They registered voters. They monitored elections. There were black senators and governors from places like Louisiana and Mississippi, something that we haven't seen ever since then. The problem was that we didn't keep that promise, that there was a disputed election of 1876. Federal troops pulled out of the South, and Reconstruction came to an end. And we started to see things like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses and property requirements. And an entire segment of society was disenfranchised, in some places almost overnight. And those official mechanisms of voter suppression were backed up by unofficial mechanisms: violence, fraud, economic retribution, social retribution. And that's how we got a situation where, before the Voting Rights Act was passed, only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote in Alabama, in Selma, Alabama. Only 6.7% were registered in Mississippi. This wasn't just something that affected African Americans. It affected all Americans. It meant that white Americans in the South had to appeal to the lowest common denominator of segregation to be able to get elected. It meant that we weren't really a true democracy. It can't be a true democracy when an entire segment of the population is prevented from voting in one of the most populous parts of the country. And so this was a situation that the Congress began to try to deal with in the 1950s after the civil rights movement really began. And what happens is, after the Montgomery bus boycott and after Martin Luther King emerges, is the Congress realizes that they have to do something about civil rights. And they passed the 1957 Civil Rights Act, they passed the 1960 Civil Rights Act, and they passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But none of these civil rights acts end the problem of voting discrimination, where only 2% of African Americans are registered to vote in a place like Selma. And they're faced with not just poll taxes and literacy tests, but constant daily harassment and violence and retribution. And so Martin Luther King went to Selma in early 1965 to challenge this situation, to try to push for a Voting Rights Act. And he met President Johnson after he had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And this scene is in the movie Selma, for those of you that have seen it. And King tells Johnson, I'm going to Selma to push for a Voting Rights Act. And Johnson tells King, well, I'm for that, but it's not going to happen this year. I just passed the Civil Rights Act. I have all this other stuff on my plate, Medicare, Medicaid, Great Society. It's just going to have to wait. And King says, well, I'm going there anyway, and we're going to make you do this. And what happens is, when there's a march from Selma to Montgomery led by Congressman John Lewis, the central character in my book, the marchers are brutally beaten, and Selma triggers the public conscious like no other event before that. People knew about poll taxes, people knew about literacy tests, but there was something about seeing so many unarmed people beaten, almost killed, simply for marching for voting rights that stirred the conscience of the nation to say, this can't happen again. We can't wait on a Voting Rights Act. This needs to happen now. And so right after that, 8 days after Bloody Sunday in Selma, President Johnson introduces the Voting Rights Act of 1965 before the Congress, a very stirring speech and one that I would urge everyone to watch, if not on Constitution Day, then sometime near after. And the president makes a moral case for voting rights, a case about why it should be important to all Americans. And he says, it's wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote. And the Voting Rights Act passes over the objections of Southern conservatives in August 1965. And it's the most powerful piece of civil rights legislation, and really one of the most powerful pieces of legislation ever passed by the government. I just want to talk quickly about a few things that it did and then why it's been so important over the years. So the Voting Rights Act knocked out things like literacy tests that had been used for so long to disenfranchise voters in places like Alabama. It sent federal officials to the South to register voters, which was absolutely transformative. You had a situation where local registrars in places like Selma hadn't registered anybody for decades, and suddenly you had hundreds and then thousands of people registered within days. It kept federal officials in the South to monitor elections, to make sure they weren't stolen. And then over a longer period of time, what it said to those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination is that they had to approve their voting changes with the federal government to make sure they wouldn't discriminate in the future, to make sure that the Voting Rights Act didn't suffer the same cruel fate as Reconstruction, that this wasn't just going to be something that we enforced for a few years and then forgot all about, and that people were disenfranchised all over again. Because you have to remember, the U.S. is the only advanced democracy that has ever enfranchised, then disenfranchised, then re-enfranchised an entire segment of the population. And so really, when you think about voting rights, you have to realize that what should be the most settled of all rights, the right that we all believe is necessary in a democracy, the right to vote, this right has remained throughout American history the most contested. And it remained the most contested even after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And so much of my book, Give Us the Ballot, is dedicated to what happened after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, because I think it's critically important to tell the story of what happened after 1965, because so many accounts of the civil rights movement end with Selma and the triumphant passage of the Voting Rights Act as the culmination of the civil rights movement. But we're left to wonder, what happened 50 years later? Why was the Voting Rights Act so important? What did it do? Why does it still matter today? Those were all the questions that I felt like weren't really being covered by so many accounts of the civil rights movement and really what I wanted to cover in my book. And so what we see is that the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act is challenged immediately by Southern states led by South Carolina. And they argue essentially that the federal government doesn't have the power to tell states how to run their elections. And the Supreme Court says in 1966, on the first anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, that the Voting Rights Act absolutely is constitutional. It's meant to enforce the 15th Amendment, and the exact purpose of it is to tell states how to run their elections, because states like Alabama and Mississippi and South Carolina and Georgia had been discriminating for so long. And so what happens after the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act is upheld is that states begin to think of new strategies for trying to thwart the power of the Voting Rights Act. And I call this the counter-revolution. And the first real phase of the counter-revolution after 1965 is that Mississippi holds a special legislative session in 1966, and they pass 13 voting changes that are meant to prevent newly registered African-American voters from being able to actually win election, to actually have real representation. So they do things like they gerrymander districts so that an African-American candidate just can't be elected. Or they switch all their elections so they're done on a countywide or a citywide basis. So if there's a white majority and that white majority won't vote for a black candidate, all the candidates are then white. So take Jackson, Mississippi, for example, a place that was 40% African-American and 60% white. Well, elections were structured citywide. and the white majority wouldn't vote for an African-American candidate. So all the elected officials remained white even after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And not just white Americans, but it meant that they were conservative segregationists, because the white majority also wouldn't vote for more moderate white candidates either at that point in time. And so these new voting changes are challenged before the Supreme Court. And there's a very influential decision in 1969 called Allen versus State Board of Elections, where the Supreme Court says that the Voting Rights Act isn't just about voter registration, isn't just about striking down literacy tests, it's about the power of the vote. Earl Warren, the great Chief Justice, says it's about everything that makes a vote effective. So this really broadened the power of the Voting Rights Act, because it wasn't just gonna be about one type of voting change or another, it was gonna be about a broad interpretation of the right to vote, the broadest possible interpretation of the right to vote, that it wasn't just about the ability to register, it was about the ability to actually have a meaningful say in your community, so you could actually change your circumstances, so you could represent, you could elect candidates who would actually represent you. And that was a really powerful statement, and the Supreme Court also said that places like Mississippi then had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And so that, again, should have settled the debate over the Voting Rights Act, but it didn't. What we started to see is, particularly within the Republican Party, that Southern conservatives became more powerful. Many of the Southern Democrats who had blocked civil rights legislation for so long, they then became Republicans. And you saw that Richard Nixon in 1968 had a very public Southern strategy, and people like Strom Thurmond, the senator from South Carolina, who was a longtime segregationist, they became very influential within the Republican Party. And you started to see a broad backlash against the civil rights laws of the 1960s, particularly in one political party. At the same time this backlash was going on, there were debates over whether to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. Because as Janetta mentioned, parts of the Voting Rights Act, particularly the part that states, certain states had to approve their voting changes with the federal government, those were temporary. They needed to be reauthorized by Congress. And so the first debate over reauthorization was in 1970. And the Nixon administration didn't want to renew the Voting Rights Act in a meaningful way. And this really set the tone that we'd see future administrations, the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration, the George W. Bush administration, did not want to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. But what we also saw is very strong pushback from the Congress, from both Democrats and Republicans. And what emerged was a bipartisan consensus in the Congress for reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act. And not just reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act, but expanding it. And so the 1970 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, which ended up overwhelmingly passing the Congress, it abolished literacy tests nationwide, and it lowered the voting age to 18 for all federal elections. So that enfranchised 9 million new voters. And the Voting Rights Act really, although it was initially addressed at African Americans for good reason because of the disenfranchisement in the South, it soon became the vehicle for expanding voting rights for all Americans. When the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized again in 1975, it was broadened to encompass language minority groups, so Hispanics, Native Americans, Asian Americans. This covered millions of new voters. It meant that certain states with the long record of discriminating against those voters, like Texas, had to approve their voting changes with the federal government as well. It also meant that bilingual ballots had to be printed all across the country where there was a significant amount of bilingual voters, because English-only ballots had functioned as de facto literacy tests in places like Alaska or Texas or in many parts of the West as well. And so this was powerful, these expansions of the Voting Rights Act, and there was a strong bipartisan consensus not just for the Voting Rights Act, but for expanding voting rights for all Americans. But what you see is that even though there was this consensus for this, there was also a counter-revolution against the Voting Rights Act that still picked up steam. And really, this counter-revolution picked up particular steam during the Reagan administration. And it was interesting to hear so many Republican candidates praise Ronald Reagan, and you know, President Reagan did do some good things, but what wasn't mentioned at the Republican debate last night was that Reagan opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he opposed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and he opposed the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And so this was very radical at the time for someone to be the Republican president having opposed the three great civil rights statutes of the 1960s showed that the Reagan administration was going to be go in a very different direction when it came to civil rights issues. And they made a very influential new critique of the Voting Rights Act. They argued that things like the Voting Rights Act had become forms of affirmative action in the electoral sphere. And Reagan made an argument which became known as colorblindness, that any attempt to try to rectify historic instances of discrimination, whether through drawing districts to help blacks or Hispanics get elected, or busing, or increased diversity in admissions, or affirmative action, that all of these things, these attempts to remedy discrimination, had instead become discriminatory. And this was the major case that the Reagan administration made about the Voting Rights Act and similar pieces of civil rights legislation. So why am I focusing so much on Reagan today? Well, because some of the disciples of the Reagan administration are incredibly influential today. One of them is John Roberts, who is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, someone that I write a lot about in the book. Roberts was someone who graduated from Harvard Law School and then joined the Reagan administration. Before joining the Reagan administration, he clerked for Justice Rehnquist. Justice William Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice, was extremely conservative on civil rights issues. Rehnquist argued that Brown versus Board of Education was unconstitutional. He argued that an all-white primary in Texas was constitutional. He personally administered literacy tests in Phoenix when he was a Republican Party official to black and Hispanic voters. So he had a long track record of opposition to civil rights. He was an old school civil rights conservative. And that was something that influenced Roberts. And then the views of Rehnquist, which were very radical, Rehnquist was called the Lone Ranger when Nixon appointed him because he was so radical, those views became adopted by the new Reagan administration and by people like John Roberts. And John Roberts was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department. And at that time, the Voting Rights Act was due to expire once again in 1982. And Roberts relentlessly waged a battle with the Congress to take the most narrow possible interpretation of the Voting Rights Act, if they were gonna reauthorize it, to make it as weak as possible. And he wrote memo after memo after memo, arguing that if you reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, it would lead to things like quotas in electoral politics, that would lead to proportional representation and affirmative action in the electoral sphere. This was an argument that Roberts lost. Republicans and Democrats in Congress once again joined together to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And you had crucial Republican moderates like Bob Dole of Kansas who led this effort, who stood up to Ronald Reagan, who stood up to John Roberts. But nonetheless, what we see is 30 years later, when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, and I'll talk about that decision in a little bit, that decision was written by John Roberts. And so it didn't just come out of nowhere. This was a product of 30 years, really 50 years of opposition to the Voting Rights Act. I just want to move forward a little bit because, so if the first phase of the counter-revolution was this states' rights conservatism, and if the second phase of the counter-revolution was this notion of colorblindness, I argue that the third phase of the counter-revolution really began during the 2000 election in Florida. And I'll explain why. I think everyone remembers hanging chads and butterfly ballots and Catherine Harris and Jews voting for Pat Buchanan in Palm Beach mistakenly. But there was another part of that election that was even more significant that didn't get a lot of coverage. And that was that the state of Florida, through a private entity, did a massive voter purge in the run-up to the 2000 election. And there were, the point of the purge was that the state claimed that thousands of felons were illegally on the voting rolls and needed to be purged. And Florida was one of those states that prevented ex-felons from voting, a law that, by the way, dated back to the Jim Crow era. It was passed in 1868, and it remained on the books in 2000. And there was two big problems with this purge. The first problem was that it was highly inaccurate, that there only needed to be a 70% match between the felon database and the voter registration database. That meant that people were tagged as felons even if their race was different, their sex was different, their middle name was different, their last name was different. But nonetheless, if there was just a 70% match, if my name was spelled A-R-I-E instead of A-R-I, something like that, I was put on the purge list and I was wrongly told I was a felon. The second problem with the list is that it was discriminatory, that African Americans were 11% of Florida's electorate, but they made up 44% of this purge list. So what happened on Election Day 2000 in Florida, in addition to all the other problems that we read about, is that people were wrongly told they were felons, they were prevented from voting, and they were disproportionately African-American voters. And this was significant for two reasons. The first reason was that the Civil Rights Commission found that the voter purge violated the Voting Rights Act. So this actually was an election that was fundamentally illegal. The second problem was that after the election, the NAACP sued Florida and they ran the numbers using stricter criteria. They found that 12,000 people were wrongly labeled as felons. And that was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory. So it's very, very possible that this voter purge cost Al Gore the election and forever changed the trajectory of our country. Why was it so important for voting rights? I think because there were elements, particularly in the Republican Party, that realized after getting away with this voter purge that small manipulations in the electoral process could make a very big difference in close elections, and that changing the voting rules in one way or another could impact a close election. We saw that in 2004 in Ohio, when there were far fewer voting machines at heavily minority, heavily Democratic districts than there were in heavily Republican, heavily white districts. And as a result of that misallocation of resources, African Americans in Ohio waited 52 minutes to vote during that election, compared to only 18 minutes for whites. And we saw 7-hour lines in places like Cleveland and Columbus. So instead of fixing the problem after the 2000 election in Florida, the problem really got worse. And the new Bush administration, the second Bush administration, started talking relentlessly about voter fraud. And this became a dominant narrative. And they use this focus on voter fraud, even though there was no actual evidence of voter fraud, they use this focus of voter fraud to build support for new voting restrictions. And this campaign really took off after the election of Barack Obama, which was a huge tipping point. I think many people saw Obama's election as a good thing. The 2008 electorate was the most diverse in American history. It was younger, it was more diverse, it was more progressive, it was larger than we had ever seen before. And there were many people that forecasted at the time that the opposition party, the losing party, would have to reach out to these new constituencies, would have to reach out to younger voters and black and brown voters and women voters. What people didn't see happening was that instead of reaching out to these voters, they would instead try to make it harder for those voters to actually be able to vote and participate in the political process. And what happened after the 2010 election, and this is really when I started covering voting rights, was that a bunch of state legislatures flipped from blue to red. This wasn't as big of a problem in a red state like Utah, which, you know, has been long controlled by Republicans, but in states like Ohio and Iowa and Wisconsin, you saw a major shift of power. And we started to see a wave of new efforts to make it harder to vote. These were things like, for example, shutting down voter registration drives, cutting early voting, eliminating reforms like same-day registration, requiring strict forms of government-issued ID that you never had needed before to cast a ballot, preventing ex-felons from voting, purging the voting rolls. And all of this was happening at once on a level that we had never seen before. Between 2011 and 2012, there were 180 new voting restrictions introduced in 41 states, and half the states in the country passed laws making it harder to vote. And these weren't just states in the South. These were crucial swing states in the North, places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio and Iowa that did not have a long history of voting discrimination, that didn't have the same type of debates as Mississippi over the years. So I found this to be a very, very alarming development. And I wrote about it first for Rolling Stone, and then I've covered it extensively for The Nation from 2011 onward. What we saw, interestingly enough, in 2012 was that many of these laws backfired, that 10 of these new voting restrictions were blocked in court, that there were major mobilization efforts to try to defeat them. I was in Ohio on election day 2012, and there was higher black turnout than there was in 2008 because people were so motivated to vote in the face of these new barriers. People felt like if you were gonna take their vote away, they had to do something about it. What was so interesting after that election was that voter turnout went down relative to 2008 in 2012 among all groups, except for African Americans 55 and older. And I'm convinced that those people who lived through the civil rights movement, who knew what these barriers were in 1965, or at least were old enough to hear about them, that they were most committed to vote to show that this wasn't gonna happen again. And so in many ways, 2012 was a success story, that voter suppression backfired, there was a backlash to the backlash, as I call it. The problem was that right after Obama's reelection, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to the Voting Rights Act from Alabama, ironically, the state that was responsible for the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And what the Supreme Court did is they struck down the formula that dictated that those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination, primarily in the South but not exclusively, had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And John Roberts, in his majority opinion, argued that history had changed since 1965, but the Voting Rights Act had not. And he used the very successes of the Voting Rights Act, the election of President Obama, the election of black mayors in places like Selma, Alabama, as a reason to then argue that the most important protections of the Voting Rights Act were no longer necessary. And what I try to show in my book is that there's a different story, that yes, history did change since 1965. Yes, we did make a tremendous amount of progress. The problem is that voter suppression didn't end in 1965 either, that the debate over voting rights didn't end in 1965, that this has never been a settled issue, that there have always been attempts in the decades since to try to make it harder to vote, and those efforts have particularly taken place today. So there was a central irony of that decision, that Roberts was arguing that the important provisions of the Voting Rights Act weren't needed at the very moment that all of these states were passing new laws to make it harder to vote. So what has happened as a result of that Supreme Court decision? Well, laws that were previously blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, were allowed to go into effect. Multiple courts have found that ID law violates the Voting Rights Act because hundreds of thousands of registered voters don't have a government-issued ID, they don't have access to one, and there are barriers to getting one. You have to pay for the underlying documents like a birth certificate to be able to get a driver's license. Or Texas, for example, is one of those states where a third of counties in Texas don't have a DMV office. And so if you don't drive and you live in rural Texas and you don't have a driver's license, how are you supposed to get to the next adjoining county 100 miles away in a state that has virtually no public transportation? That law was also drawn in such a way that a handgun permit was considered an acceptable form of a voter ID, but a state university ID was not. So it was crafted in a very specific way to discriminate against certain type of voters. And appeals court just unanimously found that law discriminated against black and Hispanic voters because they were less likely to possess this form of ID. So laws that were blocked as discriminatory were allowed to go into effect. The second thing is that states like North Carolina passed new voting restrictions. And North Carolina was a remarkable case study because a month after this Supreme Court decision, North Carolina passed a sweeping rewrite of its election laws that essentially repealed or curtailed every voting reform in that state. North Carolina actually had pretty good election laws, but what the state legislature did there is they cut early voting, they eliminated same-day voter registration, they required strict ID, they eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, which was taught in high school civics class, to encourage people to vote when they turned 18. They eliminated Citizens Awareness Month, which was done by the state to encourage people to register. And we had seen states doing one of these things or two of these things, but the fact that it was done all in one place in North Carolina was very alarming. And so what happened in 2014, which was the first election after this Shelby County decision, was that thousands of people were turned away from the polls in North Carolina and Texas. Without these protections, voters were disenfranchised. And these were people that had voted for many, many years. And these are stories I tell in the book. Military veterans, elderly voters, disabled voters, people that had been casting a ballot for all of their lives were suddenly disenfranchised because they couldn't comply or they didn't even know about the new laws. And so we're facing a situation today where the 2016 election is going to be the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And 15 states already have new voting restrictions in place for the first presidential cycle in 2016. And these are important swing states like Wisconsin and North Carolina. So when everyone talks about how important turnout's going to be, this is really the sleeper issue. What's the law going to be? How are people going to be able to participate? What's going to be the impact on people's ability to actually overcome their barriers? And what I'm concerned about is that heading into 2016, that there's going to be new restrictions passed, that as state legislatures come back in early 2016, they're going to pass these things closer to the election when they're harder to block. There's also going to be things done at the local level, particularly in the southern states, that we're not even going to know about. They're going to be very hard to try to figure out. Moving a polling place, for example, closing down a polling place, things that make a big difference that previously had to get federal approval for under the Voting Rights Act. Now these places are going to be able to do this and only be challenged after the fact. So I don't want to depress everyone too badly on this evening. I'm glad that everyone came out. So I want to end, before we open it up to Q&A, with some solutions, because there's actually a lot of good ideas out there that could boost political participation. What we're lacking is not the ideas. What we're lacking is the political will to actually implement them. One thing that could be done is restoring the Voting Rights Act. And this is critically important, because I think that as long as we have a weak Voting Rights Act, we're going to have a weak democracy. We're going to have a crippled and plagued democracy. And so there's a very interesting bill in Congress called the Voting Rights Act Advancement Act of 2015 that I'd urge people to check out. It's being sponsored by civil rights icons like John Lewis, and it just got the first Republican co-sponsor, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who's had a lot of experience dealing with Native Alaskans in her state who have faced a tremendous amount of discrimination over the years. The other thing that I think we need to do, not just relating to voting discrimination, is pass reforms that make it easier for everyone to vote. And these are things like early voting and same-day voter registration and online voter registration. Pennsylvania just became the 23rd state to pass online voter registration. That means that 27 states don't have online voter registration. In this day and age when I can do everything on my iPhone, the fact that I can't even register on my iPhone in many states is crazy. And I think at the very least, we should be figuring out a way to use all this technology to turn our antiquated 19th century electoral system into a 21st century electoral system. There's also new ideas to try to bring more people into the political process. Oregon just adopted automatic voter registration, which is very interesting. Previously, voter registration has been something that's always been placed on the individual rather than the state. And voter registration has actually been used historically to keep people out of the political process, to make it harder for them to participate as opposed to bringing people in. And so what Oregon is saying is that anyone who interacts with a DMV or a government office is automatically going to be registered to vote. And then it's on them to opt out, as opposed to the current system where I have to say that I want to be registered to vote. And this is potentially transformative, because the state is basically saying it's our responsibility that we are better as a democracy when more people participate, which you think should be a relatively uncontroversial statement. But nonetheless, the fact that Oregon is the first state to do this and it goes into effect next year is potentially very significant, because California is the next state that's considering this. And California just passed automatic voter registration, and we're waiting to hear if the governor is going to sign it there. But there's 6.6 million unregistered people in California, and being able to automatically register them is crucially important. We still have to get them out to vote, but registration is the prerequisite for voting. And so to be able to get some of these people, younger people, African Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans, some of those people who have been historically excluded from the political process or need more of a nudge to be able to participate, to get them automatically registered, I think would be very, very significant. So I think we're at a moment when there are unfortunately far too many attacks on the right to vote, which I document in my book. But I also think we're at a moment where, because of those attacks, people are understanding the importance of the right to vote, that we did take the Voting Rights Act and things like that for granted for so many years. And now people are realizing how important these laws were, that we really have to take affirmative steps to try to expand voting rights, that we can't live in a democracy where more than half the citizens on a regular basis choose not to participate. And so I think I'm gonna leave it there and make sure that we have time for questions, but thank you to everyone for listening. I was 1 minute under.
I had a question.
Knowledge is power, as they say.
My question was about the Texas voter ID law that has won on the district court level, one at the Fifth Circuit, I think one at an en banc panel, I'm not sure, but seems destined to go to the Supreme Court. What is your prediction, given the current makeup of the court? Will it be a repeat of Shelby County? Will it be a little bit of a retreat towards what it used to be, or what's your prediction?
So it's a very good question, and just to give some background, the Texas voter ID law was blocked under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was this provision that said that those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination, like Texas, had to preemptively approve their voting changes with the federal government, and that law was then blocked in federal court and opposed by the Justice Department. Now the Justice Department is challenging Texas's voter ID law under another part of the Voting Rights Act known as Section 2. Section 2 applies to all states, so you can file a Section 2 lawsuit in Utah, but it's harder to file them because the burden of proof is on those facing discrimination to try to strike down the law. It's a more complicated test for striking it down, and the law can only be struck down after it's in effect, and there's a record of evidence showing what it will do in many cases. And so a lot of times these laws can only be blocked after people are already disenfranchised, which is the unfortunate problem. And so it was this part of Section 2 that John Roberts challenged when he was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department. And the backstory here is that Section 2 was used to challenge an election system in Mobile. In Mobile, Alabama was one of those places that had citywide elections. And even though African Americans were a third of the population in Mobile, the white majority there wouldn't vote for a white candidate, wouldn't vote for a black candidate. And so the citywide election system was challenged, and people wanted districts so that there would actually be districts that would elect African American candidates. And that law was struck down in the lower courts. The at-large or the citywide elections in Mobile were struck down because there was a finding that there was an effect of discrimination. The law effectively disenfranchised African-American voters in that city. What the Supreme Court said in a very surprising 1980 decision was that you had to show proof of intentional discrimination, that you actually had to find evidence in the legislature or in a city council where people said, we passed this election to try to prevent blacks and Hispanics or Asian Americans or whomever from being able to be elected. By the 1980s, states had become more sophisticated. They weren't saying that kind of thing. So a finding of intentional discrimination was incredibly difficult to prove. This was a crippling blow to the Voting Rights Act. And John Roberts was arguing that you had to have a finding of intentional discrimination, or else it was going to lead to things, as I mentioned earlier, like quotas in electoral politics. So Roberts lost that fight. The Congress amended Section 2, so you just had to show the effect of discrimination, not the intent. And this led to thousands of election systems being struck down that prevented minorities and, in many cases, progressive whites from being able to be elected. And so now the concern is that if, for example, the Texas voter ID case comes back before the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court will once again try to narrow the Voting Rights Act, and that the fight that John Roberts lost in the 1980s is something that he could relitigate now. And that would be very, very ironic, because one of the reasons the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was they said, well, you still have Section 2, so there's really no problem. So if the court would then come back and say, well, we're not so crazy about Section 2 either, then that would clearly show that they're just not crazy about the Voting Rights Act in general. There's a few all the way in the back. Down here.
It's okay. I'm short. I'm hard to see. So I'm with the League of Women Voters here in Utah, and last year we worked very hard on the Sensenbrenner Bill, the Voting Rights Amendment Act. While not perfect, we saw it as a way to restore Section 5. Yeah. I'm interested in what your opinion is of that bill and whether we will see it come back.
Yeah. So there have been two bills that have been introduced to try to restore the Voting Rights Act. The first bill that was mentioned was called the Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, and that was sponsored principally by Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, who chaired the House Judiciary Committee during the 2000 reauthorization of the VRA. It was a modest bill that would have restored the requirement for some states to have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. There were only a few states covered, but it nonetheless would have been a positive step forward. There was also some other parts of the bill that would have been very helpful in terms of filing future lawsuits and offering more protection. That bill, unfortunately, didn't go anywhere. The Republican leadership, particularly Eric Cantor, who at that point was the House Majority Leader, promised that there would be a vote on the bill on the floor. There never was. The Republicans who chaired the House Judiciary Committee were unwilling to move it. So that bill basically died. So then what happened is this year, congressional Democrats introduced a tougher bill called the Voting Rights Advancement Act. Basically, they changed one word in the bill from amendment to advancement, which is a little confusing. But basically, that bill is more sweeping. It covers more states in terms of having to approve their voting changes with the federal government. It also adds more protections in terms of the types of things that have to either be submitted for approval or makes it easier to file lawsuits against these new types of voting restrictions. And that bill, while definitely does not have a chance of passing in this Congress, even though Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, just endorsed it, which is very important because now it has bipartisan appeal, that bill is important because people are in the voting rights community are more excited about it. There's more momentum behind it. And it would really kind of lay the groundwork for future discussions. And I think while many people want to get this done before 2016, I think there's a realization that this is not going to pass in the current Congress. That, you know, the Congress that is about to once again shut down the government over Planned Parenthood isn't likely to restore the Voting Rights Act anytime soon. So I think it's important to keep pushing this to get the issue out there. And who knows? You never know what will happen. Maybe there'll be some extremely egregious new example of voter suppression that will galvanize the public to pass this thing. But I also think we have to realize that a different kind of Congress could react very differently to this legislation, and a different Supreme Court, if a case on the Voting Rights Act came before it, I think would interpret the Voting Rights Act very differently, because this was only a 5-4 decision. So a different Supreme Court with a different majority would interpret these things very differently.
What was, like in 1993?
Yeah.
Like the Clinton administration withdrew the nomination of Lonnie Guinier?
Yeah.
What effect did that have on voting rights? And
so it's a good question. So I write about this in my book. Lonnie Guinier was someone who had both served in the Justice Department and was a civil rights lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And she had litigated many voting rights cases. And what Lonnie, when she entered academia, was thinking about was the next generation of voting rights cases. And what she was saying was, it's not just enough to strike down literacy tests and poll taxes. It's not just enough to elect some African-American candidates. Because in most places, even after African-Americans or Hispanics were elected, they still weren't the majority in many, many places. And so Lonnie was thinking about how not just to get representation, but a fair share of political power, that those newly elected officials would actually be involved in the running of their communities. So she had some interesting ideas, some outside-the-box ideas for trying to boost representation. And those ideas, while well-received in academia, were very controversial when President Clinton nominated her to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, to run the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, which enforced the Voting Rights Act and the civil rights laws of the 1960s. And so, unfortunately, instead of having a conversation about equitable distribution of political power, about the next level of representation, she was demonized. She was called a quota queen in the Wall Street Journal, and President Clinton had to withdraw her nomination. And I think it was an unfortunate example of the difficulty of having these kind of sophisticated conversations in our current political environment. I also think it showed that, you know, even Democrats who believe in an expansive view of voting rights have to retreat when they're faced with these labels like quotas, for example. So I think it was an unfortunate episode. I'm not sure it's directly related to our politics today, but I think it would be very, very difficult still to have someone like Lonnie Guinier running the Civil Rights Division, unfortunately.
Hi, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
It seems that your topic and people who are knowledgeable about this are all describing kind of a disease. They're sort of doctors who are looking at the pathology of our system. I wonder if you'd just like to sort of step back from that and do the, what would a healthy system look like Australia or a lottery system where all the voters get to split up money that's divvied up to every person eligible to register.
Yeah.
And they get to keep their money,
yeah,
non-voters' money, things like that.
Well, Australia has compulsory voting, which I can't even imagine what someone like Donald Trump would say about that. But I mean, people vote there. I mean, people have to vote. And if they choose not to, there's a penalty. And it's just a totally different way of thinking about citizenship. Australia is arguing that if you want to be a citizen of Australia, you have a duty to vote. And we've unfortunately never had that kind of affirmative belief in our country, that we delegate a lot of power to our states to do as they like in our federal system, that we never have gotten a fundamental constitutional protection for the right to vote that says that you shouldn't make it harder to vote unless you have a very good reason to do so. I mean, there's obviously going to be more lawyerly language for an actual amendment, but we have nothing like that. We have bans on racial discrimination voting. We have bans on other kinds of barriers to participation, but we don't have a blanket protection for voting rights. The other problem that we have, not just in terms of our voting rights, is that the length of our elections, the amount of money in our elections, the way the media covers our elections, these are all things that are done totally differently in advanced democracies, like in Europe. In Europe, for example, they have much shorter campaigns. Those campaigns are publicly funded. They have state media that actually focuses on substantive issues, not just celebrity candidates. It's not perfect. There's crazy candidates that get elected in those countries, but it's a far, far better system than the one that we have. And I really view the Shelby County decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act and the Citizens United decision that said that essentially corporations are people and money is our speech. Those, I view them as twins, twin decisions that have really attacked our democracy, because they're both part of an attempt to give the most affluent, the most powerful, the most influential, the most political power, and then to limit the power of everybody else. And so I really think that there's a lot of reforms that we could adopt. I think the best thing we could do in the interim is getting a different Supreme Court.
Next question here. Great presentation, enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Most definitely very informative, knocked the dust off some of the information I had forgot about. Being a person that's been in several states during the occupation, not doing manufacturing, and had opportunity to live in Europe, I agree with you, the European system by far is a much better system than what we have. What does it take, in a two-part question, to facilitate our voting acts and rules to have it where it's united across the nation instead of each individual state picking and choosing what it does, which means it looks like we're not united, we're separate and have 50 individual voting policies instead of being one united front And I agree with you from a technology standpoint. You couldn't tell me at the age of 10 growing up in South Carolina that I could do anything on the phone, much less carry one in my pocket. We need to be more automated to make it an easier process and less, I'll say, easy to manipulate.
So I think in terms of your first question, I mean, the states are always going to have a lot of power because, you know, we are a federalist system. And so there's always going to be discretion in terms of, you know, not just what states can do, but what counties can do. And there's different, even different precincts run their elections differently than others. But I also think we could say to those states, you have to have some minimum standards. And it's interesting, when Hillary Clinton gave a voting rights speech recently, she laid out some of these minimum standards. She proposed, for example, that every state should have 20 days of early voting, that every state should have online voter registration, that ex-felons should have the right to vote in all states after they have served their time and paid their debt to society. And I think we're unfortunately a ways away from getting the type of Congress that would do this, and we're a ways away from getting states to agree on this, because one thing that we're seeing is that certain states are taking very affirmative steps to make it easier to vote, and then other states are making it much harder for people to vote. And so we're almost facing like a two-tiered electoral system, that if you live in Texas, it's a much different experience voting than if you live in California, for example. And so there really is not a consensus among state officials or in our elected bodies over what the minimum standard should be. But I think good ideas have been laid out, as I mentioned earlier, about what they should be. And we just need the political will to actually carry them out.
I have a question regarding making voting and registration easier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really concerned about the security of technology and whether or not these easing of registration voting procedures can create opportunities for fraud or expand, you know, make it less safe or less secure in terms of voting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an issue that's going to have to be addressed. And I think Oregon has mechanisms built in to make sure that there is not fraud. And I mean, I think if we can, you know, pay our credit card bills, which is, you know, for some people, thousands of dollars on our phones, then certainly we should, I think, at least be able to register to vote on them. And I'm not necessarily advocating voting on your phone. I'm just saying register to vote. Just do that basic step online and then move on after that. And so, I think there are ways, I think, to prevent against fraud. I think fraud is unfortunately used too often, not as a legitimate concern, but as an excuse not to do these things. I'm not saying you're doing that. I'm saying other people are doing that.
Well, there's certainly a lot of fraud in the credit card business.
Well, yeah, but as I'm saying, this is just about people registering to vote. This isn't about people actually voting online. And there's, for example, when new reforms have been adopted, things like early voting, for example, or things like same-day voter registration, there's no evidence that they've actually led to higher incidents of fraud. So I think we can do this in a way that both makes it easier to vote and protects against the possibility of voter fraud, which is quite rare in American elections.
I'm not familiar with automatic registration. How does that work?
Well, the way it works in Oregon, as I explained earlier, is that anyone who interacts with the DMV or requests a driver's license or a state ID, they are automatically registered to vote. And then they can opt out. So they're going to send a letter saying that you are registered to vote because the state now has their data. And then they can then opt out of that process if they like. I think, Tommy, how are we doing on time? I think we're almost out of time.
Yeah, maybe one more question.
Okay. I'm going to let someone else ask a question because you've asked a few at this point.
Okay. One of the things you've talked about is people not...
Okay, here.
Really being interested in voting. Yeah. And one of the things that's been sort of a turnoff is the electing someone that still ends up getting less than half the vote.
Yeah.
One of the remedies to that is the instant runoff voting.
Yeah.
What is your take on that?
I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good idea to do that. I think it elects different type of candidates. It makes it a more diverse candidate pool in terms of who is elected. I think that that's not just an issue, but I think the gerrymandering of political districts is a big issue, that we should be looking at independent commissions or nonpartisan commissions drawing these districts, not politicians who are already in power drawing districts for themselves. I think there are reasons why people aren't participating in the process, that they don't like the candidates, they don't believe that their vote matters, they don't believe that any of the real substantive issues are addressed, and I understand all that. I think we also have to understand that even if there are legitimate reasons why people aren't voting, there's also lots of things that are being done to prevent people from voting, and that a lot of people who want to participate aren't able to participate because they don't have the right qualifications, or they had a problem registering to vote, or they didn't get registered 30 days before an election. So one of the issues is that people don't vote because they choose not to, but another issue is that people do want to get involved and they're not able to because of various barriers. And so you look at a reform like same-day voter registration, for example. States that have same-day registration where you can show up, you can register and you can vote at the same time, they have voter turnout up to 10% higher than those states that don't. So that hasn't solved everything in those states. There's still issues in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota that have them. But we do know that when you take steps to make it easier to vote, more people do in fact vote.
Take one more.
Okay. Yeah. Well, shall we just we'll just take these two and then I'll just answer both of them.
Hi, thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you.
This has been like so educational for me. my question is that I feel as a voter that a lot of times maybe the reason people don't come out to vote is because if they have any kind of, you know, thinking about it in the same way that I do, is that sometimes, you know, things don't change because the only two parties that ever get any major votes, you know, out of the primaries are always the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah.
And yet there's so many other great candidates like the Constitutionalists and, or, you know, the other independents. And I just feel like, you know, people kind of have the attitude of, well, I'm not going to waste my vote on someone like that they're not going to get enough votes anyway for the general election.
Yeah. Okay, I'll address that, but I'm going to let this other person ask a question, then I'll answer them together.
Hi, Mr. Berman.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my question. So you had warned us that in 2016, I mean, we're going to see state legislatures across the country, they're going to pass laws that, try to restrict voting. And that makes, I mean, that scares me. I'm sure it scares a lot of people here. And there's things like, you know, Citizens United that we just feel powerless.
Yeah.
What can we do now to make sure that we can lift these voting restrictions or prevent them from happening?
Yeah. Okay, both good questions. I'll answer both of them. As to the first question, I mean, I understand people's frustration with the two-party system, and I think we're unfortunately stuck with it for quite a while. I will say, though, that there are a lot of people in 2000 that argue that there was no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush. And I think we all know how that turned out. I don't believe Al Gore would have invaded Iraq. I certainly don't believe he would have appointed John Roberts and Sam Alito to the Supreme Court. I don't think he would have let New Orleans drown underwater. And there's a whole number of things that a Gore administration, while certainly imperfect, and I'm not endorsing that, would have been a lot different than a Bush administration. So I think we are stuck with two parties, but I think there are really significant differences. I don't think anyone can see, when you watch the Democratic debates, and the first Democratic debate's going to be October 13th, they're going to have an entirely different conversation than the Republican debate we just heard last night. As to your question about what can you do, I mean, I think, you know, in those states in particular where this is a possibility, I think people need to start banging the drum now about the cost, because I think people have to feel like there's an actual political cost to making it harder to vote. Republicans in the Congress supported the Voting Rights Act for so many years, not just because they believed in it, but because they felt like there was going to be a real political price to pay. Bob Dole in 1980 said to Ronald Reagan, if we don't want to be thought of as the party of the elite, of the party that doesn't like minorities or poorer people, we have to support things like the Voting Rights Act. And so the Republican Party both did these things because they thought it was the right thing to do, but also because they realized that if they were going to remain the party of Lincoln in any sort of form, they had to support things like the Voting Rights Act. Unfortunately, the incentives in the Republican Party have changed. So many Republicans now are worried about a Tea Party candidate. They're worried about moving as far to the right as possible, that they actually think that things like the Voting Rights Act will hurt them rather than helping their brand. And we need to say to those people that there has been a long bipartisan consensus for the Voting Rights Act, that turning your back on the Voting Rights Act harms the party of Lincoln, that yes, the Voting Rights Act was passed by Lyndon Johnson. Yes, it helped principally at the beginning African-American voters. But this was something that the Republican Party was instrumental in passing and instrumental in doing over five decades. And when the Republican Party turns its back on the Voting Rights Act, it's turning its back on one of the most important achievements of that party in the modern era. So I think it's important to get that message out. I will also say that some states did hold their fire in 2015. Nevada was a good example. Nevada was a state that the state legislature flipped from Democratic to Republican. It was under one-party control for the first time since 1929. And many Republicans there were pushing for a strict voter ID law like in Texas. And it didn't pass. And it was interesting that it didn't pass. The governor wasn't so crazy about it. He was more of a moderate Republican. He didn't want to deal with this issue. And I think Nevada realized that if they passed this law, it might be unpopular. They certainly were going to get sued, either by the ACLU or the Justice Department or the NAACP. And there was a political cost to doing so, that you can't just make it harder to vote and get away with it in the shadows, like maybe you were able to do in early 2011. And so to some extent, I do think that we are breaking through. I don't think we've broken through nearly enough. But I do think that the issue is getting more attention. I certainly think it should be getting a lot more attention. I will just say as a close that the first GOP presidential debate was on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, the actual 50th anniversary when Lyndon Johnson signed the law. And the fact that Fox didn't mention it, that none of the GOP presidential candidates mentioned it, I thought was a very sad commentary on our political debate. And as a final plug for The Nation, that's why we need places like The Nation, that's why we need independent media to talk about these issues that so often get swept under the rug, to give voice to the powerless, to spotlight the things that people really care about, that really make a difference in their lives. So that's what I try to do when I write for The Nation, and that's what I try to do in my book, Give Us the Ballot. And so hope everyone buys it. I will be signing copies down there, and please join us for a reception.